I'm Brian Earle, and this is the Yes You Can segment in Zesty Garden. With me in studio is Adri Roberts, Cache County's Extension Family and Consumer Sciences Agent. And today we're going to talk about canning jars, or the bottles, and various questions associated with them. The first one is, and I get this, and I bet every canner gets it, why didn't my lid seal? What makes one batch, or if you're doing 9 bottles in a batch, why do 8 seal and then that one doesn't?
Well, if you call us, I kind of go through a troubleshooting list to kind of see why maybe your jar didn't seal. And one of the big reasons why is because you're not using hot liquid. You know, sometimes I've heard of people making their salsa at night and they get tired, so they go to bed and they put the salsa in the refrigerator. Then they get up in the morning and they take that cold salsa and put it into the jar and then try to process it, and their lid doesn't seal. That's one of the reasons why it can happen. It's got to be hot. That salsa's got to be hot. The tomatoes should be hot, especially if they're a crushed tomato. Or if you're adding liquid to those tomatoes in the jar, that water's got to be hot. If you're processing peaches, you need to make sure that syrup that you pour on top of those peaches is hot. And then you don't let them sit on the counter for hours. You get that processing done. You get the lids on. You know, it's just a very nice, effective, efficient canning flow that you have, that you get your jars ready, you put that hot syrup on, the lids go on, and they're ready to go in the canner. There's no sitting time,
much. When I see recipes for cold pack versus hot pack, is that just whatever fruits or vegetables are going in are hot versus being cold?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And so if they're cold, is it more likely that those jars tend to, I mean, they still seal if you're doing everything right, but tend to not seal more than others?
That's possible. So if you are doing the cold pack, that means
like
you're...
like beans.
Yeah.
We typically will put, after I've done all the snapping while watching a TV show or something, the beans going cold, but then my wife pours on the hot water on top of those.
Right.
And that's okay to do.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Processing time, though, is a little longer for the cold pack than hot pack?
Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. It just kind of depends. Sometimes it's just the same. Other times it varies just a little bit. Usually not, as long as you've used that hot, hot syrup or hot, hot water to go on the beans or the peaches or whatever.
What else? What are some other reasons why jars don't seal? I know the lids themselves have changed. Mm-hmm. So especially if you're used to boiling the lids, you're not supposed to boil those anymore, but just keep them in hot water.
Right.
So that could be one thing.
That could be one thing. Another thing that I find is that people are screwing their bands on too tight. And I find that sometimes if we have helpers in the kitchen, they want to make sure they're helping really good. So they really grind down on the band. And it doesn't have to be that tight. It needs to be snug, but it should not be, you know, snug. Actually, during the processing, that lid will go up and down, and that's normal to release some of that pressure and things like that. So it needs to be firm, but don't grind down on them. That's another reason why. But I've also found that people don't necessarily take the time to get a clean cloth and wipe that ring, the very, very top of the jar. Make sure there's no pieces of peaches or whatever, the sugar, whatever that could possibly make it so that lid can't attach really well to the top of the jar.
So that should be wiped down.
Right.
Just before the lid goes on.
Right, right. So everything's a nice, clean process. So
why does water come out? I mean, you fill the, I'm thinking of the beans, you fill the bean jar, and then you do the batch, and you look, and half the water's gone.
Okay. One of the reasons is you're packing too much food into your jar. You're packing it too tightly.
Okay.
Yep. Another reason
that would be me, because okay. I put my thumb and I push down on those beans, and it's like,
yep.
Get as much in there as possible.
Yeah. No, don't do that anymore.
So what are you supposed to do when you're filling the jar?
They should be pretty cozy, but do not force more into the jar. When it's full, it's full. Don't force them in. Another thing that happens, too, is people don't take the time to release the air bubbles. So if you've got a rubber scraper, just kind of go down the sides of the bottles and let those air bubbles out. That'll make your jar so it doesn't seal.
And there's some really nifty little scrapers, just little devices. I know my wife's got a long, clear plastic. It looks like a plastic knife that's really long that she just kind of sticks down in on the side and gently presses. Does it help to tilt the bottle just a little bit to see if their bubbles are coming out that
way? Sure. Yeah, as you hold the bottle and go down those sides, sure. That would help a lot. Another problem with them not sealing is that you have not covered your jar with boiling water in the boiling water bath. That water needs to go up over the top of the jar. So it really, that boiling water hits that rubber seal that's on top of the jar. Otherwise, it may not seal.
And that's in boiling water, but in the pressure canner,
it does not.
You don't have to worry about that.
Yeah. Sometimes people get confused and they only put 2 or 3 inches in the bottom of their boiling water bath and then they wonder why they didn't seal. Well, that's the pressure canner. So make sure you know what you're doing.
Any other issues? Any other questions you get as far as why didn't this seal or whatever?
I get a lot of questions on why do I have to use canning salt or why do I have to use an iodized salt? And it's not a safety issue. You can go ahead and use it. It'll just make your water cloudy for like in pickles or for beans. It's better to use the canning salt. Sometimes people have problems with their food darkening in the jar, and we recommend that you figure out some kind of lemon juice to soak them in or citric acid or something that will prevent that from browning.
Now, can you use too much? Because I noticed like our peaches can go pink sometimes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I have not heard of that.
Oh,
are you
okay.
Sure it's not the breed of peaches that just
well,
kind of makes it pink?
They're just mostly Bartlett.
Okay.
So I thought maybe it was related to having too much citric acid in the water or something.
I don't think you can have too much. I think you're okay.
Okay.
You just have pretty water.
Okay. Yeah, I guess. Anything else?
Not that I can think of.
Okay.
I think as long as you follow the directions, you'll be fine. And at the end of your Ball Blue Book, if you have a Ball Blue Book, they have a great few pages of problem solving. So if you're hitting, you know, the same major problems all the time, then you can kind of look things up and see maybe what you are doing wrong. One more thing that will right at the top of my head is that you don't have the right head space. Make sure when you have your recipe that it'll say 1.5 inches of head space or 1/4 of an inch of head space.
And so they'll be specific with each recipe about how much head space should be in there between the water that you pour in and the top of the lid.
Right. Hmm. Right. So make sure you follow that. I go and judge county fairs, and it just drives me crazy when I see jams and jellies that there's 1 inch head space. There should only be 1/4 of an inch.
Do you get your ruler out and measure?
Yes, I do. You might only get a red ribbon if you do that.
Ah. What about storing bottled food?
Oh, the important thing that you need to do, and this is something that a lot of people don't, is after that jar has sat for 24 hours, take the ring off. Wash the jar in nice warm soapy water, rinse it off, leave the ring off. And then, you know, if it's jam or something, you want to give it to somebody, you can put a ring back on. But there is bacteria that can develop if that jar, as I told you, the lid goes up and down, and there could be seepage, and that can become a problem with bacteria and things like that. So wash your jars. I just make a nice big sink of soapy water, and I stick them right down in. If your jar becomes unsealed through that process, and you didn't have a good seal anyway. So you can kind of work that out, but leave them nice and clean because that's important to avoid that problem.
You just answered a question for me. I've always been meaning to ask my wife, why is there this gigantic sack of rings downstairs? Mm-hmm. And that's why she's following the directions.
Good. Good.
Keeping those off.
Good.
Well, you've been listening to Adri Roberts. She's Cache County's Extension Family Consumer Sciences Agent, and this is our Yes You Can segment. Thanks, Adri.
You're welcome.
In this segment of the Zesty Garden, I have with me in studio Mike Wolf. He is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Wildland Resources at Utah State University. And our topic for this portion of the Zesty Garden is bats. And if you have any questions or comments at all, we're going to have a lively discussion. It's 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also paste to the... Post your question to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. And if you prefer, you can send us an email question. It is zestygarden@gmail.com. Mike, thanks for coming in.
Your pleasure to be here.
I find bats fascinating, mostly because I have a large barn right next to my garden. And when I'm out there at dusk, I see these little brown projectiles coming out of the back of that barn. And I know that they're out there eating those mosquitoes that like to bite me when I'm out weeding in the garden. So I know they're doing me a very good service. And so tell me, do you have any idea what kind of bats there are in that barn next to me? Out in the Hyde Park?
Yeah, I would presume that those are probably little brown bats and or big brown bats, which are probably the most common species that we have here in Utah. They are colonial, and so they'll gather in places like as a barns and roofs as on this sort of thing, or the belfry, the traditional belfry, and this sort of thing. And then both of those species are also hibernators, so they will probably hibernate in those structures. But yeah, they eat a prodigious amount of insects, particularly the little brown ones. It's estimated, an individual can consume 1,000 insects or something, 1,000 mosquito-sized insects in a single evening or a single night. And so you multiply that, and there's a major impact.
So if I ever hear that the neighbors are wanting to take down the barn, I need to tell them that you've got a bat colony in there, and so they're there year-round.
They're there year-round. Some of them may go out in the summertime when to what are called maternity roosts, so where the females raise their young, and it's a very quick process, so about 3 weeks or something like that before the young are capable of flight, or we call that volant and this sort of thing. But they'll often come back to traditional hibernation spots. We call them hibernacula, and those have to be kind of temperature dependent, this sort of thing. So, and they have reduced metabolism in the wintertime, so that their body temperature is near freezing, if not, you know, and they may be super cooled, and this sort of things.
So even when the temperature's dropping to 10 below, they do well enough in the barn on their own.
Seemingly, yes. So yeah. Now some with the temperatures are really, there are other species of bats that migrate, and it's hard to sort of say what the difference is, because some species may migrate a certain distance and then they'll hibernate when they get to that spot, and some species in different locations will behave differently. So the migration hibernation thing is a little difficult. There's some species, like, for instance, the bats in Logan Cave, the Townsend's big-eared bats, which are true hibernators, and they come there and do that every winter, basically to the same spot.
Now, I'm old enough that I actually climbed in Logan Cave before they put the bars on the front. Have you seen the populations of the bats rebound since there's no longer the exploration of the cave like it used to be?
I don't know as it's rebounded significantly. The last figures I heard, there might be, the Forest Service was doing, they had a biologist who was doing counts in there, and I think so the figure that came to my mind was about 300 bats, 300 hibernating bats, or maybe a fewer than that sort of thing. But I don't know if there's a significant response. So
I seem to remember reading something about the amount of food the bats needed to get each evening in comparison to their body weight, and it was a tremendous amount.
Yeah, they're kind of like flying shrews in that respect. So they have a very high metabolism and need to satisfy that with the food. Now, some bats will go into what's called torpor even in the summertime, or let's say if it gets cold, they'll just kind of shut down and sit there and will not move around. But so that reduces their body temperature and also their metabolism.
We do have a couple of email questions from Hillary. She was wanting to know if putting up bat houses around here is helpful.
It can be helpful, as you probably have to have a water source fairly nearby, because they need, especially the females need water because they're lactating. And so most successful ones would be if you live like near a river or, you know, some kind of water source and this sort of thing, that would be good. And placement is all important, because you need to place it on a south-facing aspect, because these females, the bats are born in the summertime, the young bats, and like I say, they don't really mature, but they grow up very fast and furious, if you will. So it's an awful lot of energy, and the temperature really helps as them come along. So if you are interested in looking at something like that, you might go on the web to, what is it, Bat Conservation International? Or are there a lot of different websites as though that you could? So, but they, it may be, but it's kind of location specific to some degree.
So I was thinking on the north side to be a little more protective, but you're saying on the south side is the best.
The best is, would be the south side, is it? Because they need all that heat and this sort of thing just to bring them along.
And how far above the ground should they be?
I would say several feet at least. So, you know, maybe
enough to get away from the cats.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
All right. And she also has another question. She wanted to know about, have you heard about bats being killed by the wind turbines?
Yes. And that's a very interesting situation because we know that birds, of course, are killed by wind turbines. And it was assumed that most of the bats, there's a fair amount of bat mortality that goes on in some locations. It's usually during a migration period. And we assumed at first that it was collisions with the blades of the turbines. I mean, they're going around at 120 miles per hour on the tips of those things. But there's a woman in California that did some research on them. And so she found that they were suffering from what's called barotrauma, which is basically these are pulmonary or lung lesions that they have. And it's almost like if you're scuba diving and you come up too quickly or whatever. Of course, you get the bends, but if you don't breathe properly, you can just basically blow your lungs out because of the pressure. And so what happens is that these wind turbines create a low-pressure vortex because of the blades going around, and so that may cause the lungs to burst or have lesions. So I think 85% of the animals, the bats that she found in the one study, showed pulmonary lesions.
And not just bats, but others as well?
No, this is probably true of bats, as a bird seem to be able to deal with that because they have it's not a tidal respiratory system, it's an in and out system, basically, whereas bats breathe in and out, and so you have different pressure. They're mammals, isn't it? So it's a difference between birds and mammals.
I was surprised to learn that bats make up 20% of mammal species.
Yeah, basically one out of every four mammals is a bat. The only kind of order that's even more abundant are the rodents. And, you know, it'd be said, some people say, oh, bats are rodents, but they're not. It's a separate order. And the order is called Chiroptera, which means winged hand, basically. And this is because the wings of bats are just like if you took your arms and connected them to your legs with a membrane, you'd have what basically the bats have is of their wings.
And they are the only true flying mammal. I mean, you have flying squirrels and so forth, but they're really should be called gliding squirrels.
That's correct. So, you know, sugar gliders in Australia and flying squirrels, they just get up someplace and they have, you know, they have kind of membranes between their arms and their legs, but it's not active. It's just gliding more than anything else.
Well, let's talk a little bit then about the bats specific to Utah. So there's about 1,240 bat species, and Utah is home to about 18 of those?
That's correct. So as I think I've heard a figure of 22, but 18 is sort of generally accepted.
Okay. And so most of those in Utah are going to be insect-eating bats as opposed to those that eat fruit. Now, there are, one or two fruit?
Yeah, let's step back for just a second basically the bats, there are two what we call suborders or major groups. I mean, one are called the megabats and the other one's called the microbats. And the megabats are basically, you've heard of fruit bats and flying foxes and this sort of thing. These are bats that have good vision. So they're mostly diurnal. They operate during the day and they feed on fruits and things like that. The micro Chiroptera or microbats the megabats are usually found in Australia, South America, Africa. We don't really have any in the United States. The other order, the microchiroptera, we have three families, one of which is the leaf-nosed bats. Those are the ones that would be actually like hummingbirds, almost pollinators because they feed on nectar.
Are they that small?
No, they're not. Well, they're very small.
There are some that are small.
Right, okay. Right. And then there's another order or another suborder, family, whatever. they call the free-tailed bats. And these are the bats that you see if you go to Austin, Texas, that are coming out from under the bridge in millions and this sort of thing. And if you want to go close here in Utah and find a colony, there's one down at the Freeport Center down in Syracuse, which come out during the summer.
And where are they? Where are they roosting?
They're roosting in sort of an old storage facility that I think the school board has down there. So I don't know if it's still active, but it was active several years ago. We used to have, we'd take people out there and they could watch the bats. But by far the largest number of bats in Utah are the so-called evening bats, and these are mostly insectivorous bats, more than anything else. So they wouldn't be doing much in the way of pollination. But so if you live around St. George, you might see a leaf-nosed bat and this sort of thing.
So those that are eating the insects, are they an equal opportunity devourer? In other words, whatever they come across as far as an insect, they'll take it?
No, we have actually specialists.
Okay.
So most of the genus is called the Myotis. And this is the largest genus. It has like 7 or 8 different species in it, okay? And those are a specialist more for mosquito size kind of things. But then you have some things like the hoary bats that are moth eaters or some like, what is it, the pallid bats in the desert. They may actually take beetles and things off the ground and this sort of thing. So there's a difference in what they eat, and there's also a difference in how they echolocate, because the ones that echolocation, getting into that, is the way bats navigate. Basically, they send out sonar signals, and they pick those up from their objects and impediments, and they actually can use these to locate their prey with. So the ones that have the smallest prey species have the highest frequency. We can't hear these things, so for the most part. And so they're in the range of, 60, 70 kilohertz or something like that. That's beyond human hearing. But the ones that have, the bats that specialize on kind of larger prey species, they have lower frequency echolocation signals.
So the squeaks I'm hearing from the bats as they fly around isn't necessarily part of the echolocation.
No, those would be the low level kind of things. So, but by and so yeah, when we capture some bats, we actually misnet them, and you can hear those squeaks. But the ones, the echolocation ones, are those are above human hearing and sort of thing. And the interesting thing about that is because some people have found that if you look at the frequency of these echolocation signals, it's a sine curve, and that they have found that actually some insects can kind of hide out, so to speak, in the trough of that of that curve. And so the higher the frequency, the less chance they have of that, of hiding out in that trough of the thing. So
that's really interesting. So they've evolved to know where to be in that curve, so they aren't picked out.
Yeah, the whole echolocation thing is absolutely fascinating, because what is it? Who wrote The Blind Watchmaker or whatever? Dawkins, I think, was talking about the development of sonar technology during the Second World War. And we had to develop things that the bats already had built into them. So, for instance, you know that when they submit a sound, attenuates and as the square of the distance away from the ghost and sort of thing. So if you are going to go further out, you need to be really loud, okay, and that might hurt your eardrums. So what bats have the ability, so that when they send something out, and so they're sending it out loud when things are coming back, and so they can shut off the bones of their middle ear as a something like 50 times a second or something like that. So they're not getting the damaging sound waves back. So it's sort of the old, remember the propellers in the early World War I days, that you had to learn to shoot through the propeller and this sort of thing without dinging it. And so you have to do that kind of send-receive technology. So people had to learn about this when they were developing this sonar technology, and it was already present in bats.
Are there any other animals on the planet that use echolocation?
Marine mammals, yes. So, but it's a different, because water is a different medium. And so they're probably lower frequency. We can hear those mm-hmm. well and this sort of thing. And so, yes, they do that. So there are other species that are other animals, that, but notably the marine mammals.
None other out of the water that you know of?
I don't know. There's some thought that maybe some species of shrews may do this sort of thing. But then you're talking about moving around in the soil or in the leaf litter and
yeah.
sort of thing. So.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden, and my guest is Mike Wolf. He's Professor Emeritus in the Department of Wildland Resources at Utah State University. If you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. We're having a live conversation about bats. 800-826-1495. The email address is zestygarden@gmail.com. Or you can also post to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. And so I've got a question, again, from Hillary. She said, do bats eat mosquitoes? Some sources claim bats don't eat mosquitoes. Is that true?
Oh, no, they do eat mosquitoes. So. And again, the smaller species, the little Myotis ones, would be ones that consume prodigious amounts of mosquitoes.
Well, and that was always my hope, that that's exactly right. What was happening in my own garden. And I want to talk about that after we come back from a quick break, about how to attract bats to your own area. And so we'll be back with a conversation about bats here in just a moment. So I hope you stay tuned. Welcome back to this portion of The Zesty Garden. My guest is Mike Wolf, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Wildland Resources at Utah State University, and we're talking about bats. Love to take your questions or comments. 1-800-826-1495 or email zestygarden@gmail.com, or you can go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So we do have a caller. We have Margaret in Vernal. Hi, Margaret. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, good morning. What I wanted to ask was, do we have the black bats? I'm from England, and we used to have ones about 4 or 5 inches that would come out at night. And as far as I can recollect, they were always sort of very dark. And they lived in our cellar during the day.
They lived where during the day?
They lived where during the day?
In a cellar?
In a cellar.
Huh. The cellar. Oh, sorry. This was the underneath the house, and there was a door with slots in it, to close it off from, and the steps down to it.
So I guess it was kind of like a cave for them.
Could
we used to keep the barrels of cider that we made there, and also we keep root vegetables down there. So it was a cool place.
That sounds as though that, I mean, this would be something like, for instance, we found that bats like abandoned mines. And in some ways, because caves have been broken up to some degree, that we find bats using abandoned mines. And so that's probably analogous to the cellar situation. The temperature is going to be cooler there.
Yes, it was always cool down there.
Yeah. Now, do you know if they hibernated down there in the wintertime or not? Or just, it was just a summer phenomenon?
We used to see them in the summer, but they could have been down there all the winter. We didn't go down very much into the cellar.
It sounds like they might be, you said they were dark. Really,
they were definitely a very dark color.
That would,
and they come out in the evening in the summer.
Right. I think they might have been what we call Brazilian free-tailed bats, which is when you can find some of those. Well, those are the bats that come out. You've probably heard about the bridge in Austin, Texas, where there are millions of bats that come out every evening, and those would probably be the same species. They're highly colonial.
So they have quite, their range takes them all the way up to England?
Uh-huh.
England?
Yeah, that's where she was from.
Oh, okay. Well, no, I'm sorry. They would probably
England,
be the European counterparts to that.
I was in England, not the British Isles.
Okay. But the bat's behavior, I retract what I said about the species. I don't know what species it would be, but their behavior is similar, you know, in the two continents.
Yes.
Great. Well, thank you, Margaret.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We also have a question. This is, do municipal mosquito abatement fogging programs harm bats?
I guess my answer would be probably a qualified yes. So for one, aside from the fact that they're removing the mosquitoes, I don't think that's a big problem. But so whatever the pesticide is, the bat's wings is a highly sensitive membrane, basically, and so it can absorb things almost, you know, through the skin. So for instance, when we're handling bats, we do not use like off or those insect repellents and this sort of thing. So I think the chemicals that they do use would probably be detrimental.
Okay. So if you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-826-1495, zestygarden@gmail.com, or the UPR Facebook page. So I wanted to get back to this question about how do you attract more bats to your area, because as far as I can tell, there's nothing but good about having bats around. So we've talked about putting up a bat box, making sure it's at least several feet above the ground to get away from cats and other animals on the south side of your home, or just on a barn or in a tree. Where would you put that?
I would probably put it on a barn or maybe a tree. Now, the trees themselves may provide some roosting characteristics. But it's interesting that nowadays, so when we build our homes the way we do, we basically exclude bats because there's no place for them to get in.
Yeah.
It's many of the older structures that are, I guess, sloppily built, if you want to say, so where bats can get in and spend the summer. And usually because heat rises, that's why the temperature there is higher. So it's good for bringing along the young bats, the pups as we call them, and this sort of thing. And so that's why the roofs or the attics of some of those older places would be ideal. So if you want to build sloppily or something like that, maybe you can attract bats. So, but usually we screen them out one way or another. So, but other than the structures itself, and if you happen to be maybe in the southern part of the state, as I have, you know, flowers or something like that that might attract the leaf-nosed bats, I don't really know as there's too much we can do to attract them from that standpoint.
So are there certain flowers that you would plant that would attract insects that would attract the bats, like evening-type insects?
Yeah.
I know there's certain flowers that open in the evening.
In the evening, so that's an opportunity, yeah. So you might get some moths or something like that, so would do that. I don't know if there's any flowers are going to... Well, I guess if you wanted to leave old tires lying around with water in them, which will attract mosquitoes, that might be, but that's kind of counterproductive, I think.
I've seen, and it's native to Utah, I think it's called Dicentra. It's a flower that gets really, it's quite large and
right.
White, but that would attract, I think I've seen hummingbird moths in it, so it'd have to be a pretty large bat to get that size of moth.
Yeah, it would probably be something like a pallid bat or maybe a hoary bat and this sort of thing. So they would be bigger than the small myotis.
Well, the time is going by quickly. We only have about 8 minutes left in the program to talk about this. And so what I wanted to do was to look into some of the misnomers, things people think about bats that really aren't true, such as blind as a bat. There's nothing that could be further from the truth.
Right. Now, the bats don't, they have eyes, but they're largely, at least the evening bats. Remember the microchiroptera that we talked about. So they have developed, because they are out at night, they've developed this echolocation to a greater degree than other species. And so that's why they have these grotesque ears and noses and stuff like, or seemingly grotesque, because they're using those signals, those echolocation signals, and picking up on those things to navigate, find their prey. So, yeah, maybe blind when you're talking about using your eyes, but they can get around. And in fact, when we try and capture them with mist nets, these tiny, very, very thin things, they can detect those as though with their echolocation, can fly around and fly over or whatever.
Bats in your hair?
yeah, that's just, I don't know. It's something, well.
If they can spot an insect, they should be able to spot your hair. So.
Yeah, right. I mean, I know we had a cockatiel one time, and it loved to fly into my daughter's hair and this sort of thing. And some sort of women with some of these bouffant hairdos and this sort of thing, they were worried about that.
What about bats and rabies?
Again, a misnomer. Bats, some bats, but a very, very small percentage. It's usually less than 1% of the animals are affected by rabies. And so, and they will die from rabies, basically. And so the main thing is that just don't, if a bat's acting strange, if it's flying around, don't worry about it. But if it's on the ground or something like that, or something that the cat brought in or something like that, you probably don't want to handle those because they may have rabies. And for instance, I mean, I work with bats and I get my rabies titer tested every year and this sort of thing because I had some peremptory shots years ago and this sort of thing, but it's lasted about 20 years. So.
And the big one with tomorrow being Halloween, yeah. Vampires?
Vampires, yeah. I think there's something about three different species out of the some 1,200 that do drink blood. They don't suck blood, from that standpoint. And usually it's blood that is a cow's or chickens or whatever, as they may be bleeding or
and
something.
And we're talking tropical.
Yeah,
yes?
So Mexico, Central, South America.
Okay.
I think there are a few vampire bats that get into Texas, southern Texas and this sort of thing. But again, it's a little bit like the old thing with goat suckers, you know, which are birds,
yeah.
Basically. So, and they, because they have been known to drink milk, and so people, and they have big mouths, so people used to think that they were goat suckers.
So, and are these bats feeding exclusively on blood?
No, they feed on other things as well, and this sort of thing. And of course, blood is, if you're a blood specialist, you have to be, you know, you have to work with that because it's not the easiest thing to digest in this sort of thing. So,
and we had a caller who didn't want to go on the air, but do bats hurt bees?
No, because bees are basically diurnal they're active during the day, and for the most part, bats are active at night, maybe dusk or something like that. So there's a separation of their niches.
Via email, David wanted to know, so tomorrow is Halloween, so I think it would be useful if you could answer one very important question that I'm sure many people are asking. How do you kill a vampire?
By driving a stake through its heart.
Or so did this just develop from the book about Dracula that he turned into a bat? I mean, where did all that come from? Do you have any idea?
I think these things are, you know, well, just the interview that went on here an hour or so ago, you know, the supernatural kind of thing, people picked up on that. These are old pagan tales and this sort of thing from people associating those kind of things. And then, of course, they were embellished. And it's just like...
I guess it was kind of natural. Bats fly at dark.
Right.
They look sinister if you see them.
Exactly. So these are same things that, you know, are part of folklore and this sort of thing and just have been incorporated into our literature and our being and this sort of thing. So.
What is your favorite bat?
I think I like, of the local bats, I like the so-called hoary bat. This is a bat that looks like it's a frosted bat, basically. So it has a hoar frost on it. They are mean little buggers, because when we handle those, most of the little Myotis ones, I wear gloves and a sort of thing. They can't make it through the glove, but the hoary bats can do a number on you. And they are highly migratory, so they're here in the summertime. And so normally we get maybe one of those an evening when we do some bat work, and the rest of them be some of the smaller ones.
So when you talk about doing bat work, what are you doing? You're setting up this net to catch them near a location where they're known to roost?
Actually, most of what we've done is water sources and this sort of thing. So, for instance, rivers, ponds, and things like that. I have done some work in West Box Elder County with Townsend's big-eared bats and abandoned mines over there and this sort of thing, where we've actually put little markers on hibernating bats, those little paper punches that you have from your notebook with a number on there, and we put them on with a bit of Gorilla Glue and put them on the back of their neck so they can't groom them off. Mm. And then we would see how many they were there, and we do a capture release kind of thing. So there are different aspects to it. But as far as research goes, we're only on the cusp of learning stuff about bats.
Well, in the last minute and a half that we have left, can you address the fungus that has been attacking bats along the East Coast, and now it's made its way into the Midwest? It hasn't gotten to Utah yet.
Right.
But.
Yes, this is a fungus that showed up, I think, in the early 2000s, as so 2006 or something like that. And it was found in a hibernaculum, or where bats were hibernating, in New York, western New York, and it spread to the other New England states. It's a fungus, and the animal, it's called white nose syndrome, and it looks like, I joke about it, looks like the animal's been doing crack or been in powdered sugar or something like that. And it causes lesions. One, it causes them to leave the hibernation kind of thing and go outside where the temperatures, and there's no prey out there, and so they die. So, and they also wing lesions and stuff like that. It's spread to, and it's coming slowly west. The good news is that there's some indication that, tentatively anyway, that some bats are being found that may be resistant or have developed a resistance to this. But it was just happened de novo, and as though it's really been a disaster. And there are a couple species like the Indiana bat, as though that could, the thing could cause the extinction of that bat because their numbers are very low to begin with.
Well, let's hope it doesn't get that far, and I hope that they continue to develop a resistance to it. So, well, Mike, thank you very much for coming in.
I enjoyed being here. So.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Mike Wolf is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Wildland Resources at Utah State University, and we've been talking bats. Up next is the second installment about Victory Gardens with Helen Cannon.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and I wanted to continue to talk about Victory Gardens and some of the things that war makes us more conscious of. I concluded my last session with Petals and Prose reading an essay by Virginia Woolf about air raids, and she concludes by imagining an English boy and a German boy who, after all, don't want to be fighting, don't want to be killing each other. And that reminded me of a very powerful poem by Wilfred Owen, a young man who died at the end of the First World War. And he wrote about war in an honest, utterly terrifying way. In this poem, he takes the Latin phrase, which means it's great and good to die for your country. He ends up calling it the old lie, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. It's great and good to die for your country, that old lie. Bent double like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge, till on the haunting flares we turned our backs and toward our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep. Many had lost their boots, but limped on, bloodshod. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of tired, outstripped 5-9s. Gas! Gas quick, boys! This is referring to the awful mustard gas that was so hideous and horrible. An ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But if someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime. Actually, in the essay that I read by Virginia Woolf, she mentions the gas mask that she has. No gun, but a gas mask. and floundering like a man in fire or lime, dim through the misty panes and thick green light, as under a green sea I saw him drowning. In all my dreams, before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. If in some smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in and watch the white eyes writhing in his hanging face like a devil's sick of sin, if you could hear at every jolt the blood come gurgling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues, my friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. I needn't say that that's a powerful poem. But back to the idea of rationing and victory gardens. President Roosevelt followed the lead of the Brits in calling for victory gardens and calling for rationing. And in a book about Roosevelt, Eleanor, and Franklin by Doris Kearns Goodwin, a very good historian, she writes about Roosevelt's calling for rationing. And as I said, I do remember rationing when I was a little girl. I remember mothers being angry because she had a babysitter tending me who had gone through the cupboards and located hidden chocolate, which was a rare thing. I remember mother mending her silk stockings with a little tool because silk and nylon were used to make parachutes. So to have silk stockings was a luxury, and you didn't throw them away when they got a run. You mended them. While machinery for rationing of customer goods was being devised and set in motion, the government established a series of regulations at the manufacturing level to ensure a sufficient amount of cotton and coats, or wool to supply the army with more than 64 million flannel shirts, 165 million coats, 229 million pairs of trousers. The War Production Board mandated a new victory suit for civilians with cuffless trousers, narrower lapels. Reductions in the amount of cloth allowed also led to shorter, pleatless skirts, rising several inches above the knee, and the creation of a new two-piece bathing suit. Women took the loss of pleated skirts and one-piece bathing suits in stride, but when the rubber shortage threatened the continuing manufacture of girdles, a passionate outcry arose. Though government sources tried to suggest that women grow their own muscular girdles by exercising, women argued that neither exercise nor any other known remedy could restore aging muscles to their original youthful tautness. Without proper support from well-fitted foundation garments, argued a contemporary health magazine, that a woman past 30 could keep her posture erect or do physical work without tiring. Certainly, Dixon concluded, Uncle Sam does not want American women to wear garments that would menace their health or hamper their efficiency, especially during wartime, when every ounce of effort and energy is needed. The government heeded the women's cries. Not long after the first public discussion of curtailing girdles, the War Production Board announced that foundation garments were an essential part of a woman's wardrobe and as such could be continued to be manufactured despite the precious rubber involved. I can remember that my mother used to sleep in her girdle because she thought it would help her hold her tummy in. By and large, American housewives accepted the system of rationing cheerfully. When butter became scarce, they added a yellow dye to margarine to make it look like butter. Oh, that was awful stuff. I remember it. I remember kneading the orange capsule into the bag so it looked like butter, but it surely didn't taste like butter. When sugar was cut back, they substituted corn syrup and saccharin in cakes and cookies. They planted victory gardens in their backyards. They saved kitchen fats and exchanged them at the butcher shop for points. I can remember my mother saving bacon grease in a can and then turning it into the butcher. And I can remember there was a store in Logan called Cartwright's. it wasn't possible to get tomatoes, even not in wartime. You just didn't get the sort of produce that we do now. But he would pick his green tomatoes, wrap them in newspapers, and before Christmas, he would bring out the tomatoes all ripened, and it was such a luxury to have tomatoes in a salad for Christmas. Well, the matter of rationing and of victory gardens was a matter of sacrifice, but it was also done with true grit and a willingness to help out. As this international situation grew darker and darker in the summer of 39, especially after the Nazi-Soviet non-aggression pact was signed on the 23rd of August, civilians became extremely unsettled. They sometimes tried to allay their anxieties by solid toil in the garden. A journalist, Maggie Joy Blunt, who lived in a cottage in Burnham Beeches, Buckinghamshire, wrote in her diary that when she heard news of the Soviet pact, quote, "I returned to my cottage, believing wishfully that the threatening clouds would pass. I began to prune ramblers. All that week, I seemed to be perched on top of wobbly steps in the late summer sun, wrestling with dead rosewood, wavering crimson-tipped new shoots, waiting for the news. Waiting for the news." As it turned out, she had only 10 days to wait for the news that she and so many others dreaded. Well, I would like to spend one more session talking about Victory Gardens, so time after next, I'll be back and have a few more things that have interested me and I hope will interest you about Victory Gardens. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.